90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Thursday at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News Show with Don Olson and Dave Gudnick. Well, and Dave, what do you got cooked up for today?
I got cooked up something for your cough, but we'll get to that later. I got lots of comments from several sources on the war in Iran and the increasingly visible limits to U.S. power, plus commentary on the state of Israel and the fate of Israel. A few comments of my own to start out. It's 2 months since the Memorandum of Understanding, and the situation in the war in Iran is worse than ever. Trump, the policymaker, repeatedly does more harm than good. He is trapped in a maelstrom of zero-sum thinking, profound narcissism, and an unshakable faith in his instincts. It's a combination that imposes heavy cost on a vast majority of Americans, and that's before we get to the rest of the world. Note that all 13 U.S. bases in the Gulf countries have, since February 28th, been partially or severely damaged and left dysfunctional. Iran has strategic leverage because of the importance of the Strait of Hormuz to regional and global economics. Hence, Iran is increasing its demands on the U.S. Now a couple of paragraphs from Eve Smith. I'd like to quote her frequently at nakedcapitalism.com because she produces a nice, concise summary before introducing a very long set of quotes and links and sources from elsewhere. So this is her introduction of yesterday and in today. Again, limited kinetic action and relentless Trump and administration puffery masked that Trump has no way out of his Iran disaster save an ugly exit, a formal capitulation, or blowing up more stuff in Iran and having Iran destroy the global economy. But the press keeps unquestioningly parroting hopium and administration hawk derangement. Oil experts who also called the energy crunch early are citing more evidence of its inevitable arrival, even if it might not be as dramatic as the much-touted, quote, cliff. As we and many others reported, Iran has drawn very hard red lines, adding U.S. withdrawal from the Middle East and an end to hostilities on all fronts, including Lebanon, Gaza, and now Yemen, and insisting that the Memorandum of Understanding requirements, like the return of frozen assets and sanctions relief, happen up front. The new Supreme Leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, has surfaced and even met with President Peskashian for over 7 hours. He also appointed a new very hard-line secretary, Mohsen Raziel, to Iran's Supreme National Security Council. Iran has also named 6 new military commanders. Commentators see that the significance is that Iran naming them as an exposing to assassination attempts signals that Iran believes it has sufficiently tightened its security. One more from Eve Smith. With the fabulously erratic Donald Trump in charge, the presumed trajectory of the Iran war could change radically on short notice. But the boundary conditions seem to limit that. The U.S. does not and will never have the means to subdue Iran militarily. Karen Kwiatkowski on Judge Napolitano reconfirmed what has been reported elsewhere, that the U.S. has lost every war game that simulated a war or attempted invasion of Iran. The U.S. armed services are in much sorrier shape widely, not only than in our Cold War prime. Our army is much smaller, our navy is much smaller, and has been reported widely, not only are U.S. weapons stockpiles depleted with many years expected for replenishment, but they are overwhelmingly the wrong weapons fit for big World War II style maneuver or whacking insurgencies. They are overwhelmingly high cost, fussy antiques in a new world of vastly cheaper yet highly precise drones and missiles, along with increased integration of weapons-based surveillance into a more comprehensive view of battle spaces. That's the end of quote from Eve Smith at NakedCapitalism.com. Meanwhile, we have more escalation. Seriously, Putin has threatened seizing ships in return for the kind of Western acts of piracy that Russia's been subject to. Russia is already posting a military ship to guide Russian ships through international waters in the English Channel. Similar comments on the Duran program, quote, during a visit to Russia's Far East, Putin said that if Western countries seize Russian commercial ships, Russia will seize Western vessels wherever it considers necessary, including in the area covered by its Pacific Fleet. In other words, seize a Russian ship and Moscow may take one of yours. The question now is whether the West will test that warning. Sooner or later, another Russian vessel could be targeted, forcing Moscow to decide whether its threat was simply a warning or an actual red line, unquote. Meanwhile, get this. How bad are conditions on the USS Lincoln, the only main carrier in the region, previous one having been taken in for repairs after some big fire in the laundry, maybe sabotage. Now, desperate sailors aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln have tried to jump overboard during an extended deployment in the Middle East, their families say. And I have read quotes from mothers of two of these service members. The aircraft carrier, crewed by around 5,000 sailors and Marines, has been deployed since November 25th, but more lately, that's November 25th of last year, my friends, but more lately has been supporting U.S. military operations in the war with Iran. The deployment had been expected to end in May, but has been extended with no current return date, families told the Military Times. This comes directly from the families of the stricken sailors themselves. Reports claim the conditions of shortages, that is, food shortages and other shortages, shampoo shortages, other shortages, long work hours, and low morale aboard the ship are so horrific that a mental health crisis has erupted, with sailors wishing they did not wake up tomorrow. Quote, that's from the families. Okay, this is what's happening over there for the really extended deployment, supposed to have ended a few months ago. So this is leaking out too, of course, denied by the liar-in-chief and Hegseth, but it's definitely happening. Like I say, I have listened to some of these family members, and now this is getting out. It's in the Military Times and elsewhere. Wall Street Journal, voice of the financial establishment, is not optimistic. Quote, Trump's strategy resting on a risky assumption that Iran will crack before Washington does. Mediators have warned that their U.S. counterparts that Iran has been living under sanctions for years, and betting that Tehran will compromise because of economic pressure won't likely yield results. Instead, Iran will likely continue to escalate attacks to raise the price for Washington and its allies. If Iran can outlast Washington's expectations, it has less reason to give up leverage over the Strait of Hormuz, prolonging the standoff and the risk of renewed fighting. The longer that standoff lasts, the more pressure shifts back onto Trump as energy and shipping disruptions weigh on the global economy and inflation heading into the midterm election. So here you have a unanimity of opinion about what's going on here. We have both sides trying to outlast the other one, and it appears to me that Iran is in a much stronger position given the increasing ongoing damage to the U.S. and global economies. Now, a bit more detail on how we got into this mess. This is from a site called Americanets, with a K, Americanets.com, documenting how intelligence warnings were ignored, as mentioned earlier. Quote, in mid-February 2026, before the U.S. military initiated the airstrikes that began Operation Epic Fury, the National Intelligence Council, NIC, an agency of the executive branch created to synthesize the analysis of the U.S.'s 18 intelligence agencies, submitted to the president a classified report detailing the prospects of an attack on Iran. This assessment, first reported on in the Washington Post and subsequently confirmed by the Associated Press, painted a grim picture. It concluded that an offensive operation launched by the U.S. military would be unlikely to dismantle the central pillars of the Iranian government. Assassinating Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei would backfire, resulting in the consolidation of Iranian military and political structures and the activation of emergency protocols the Iranians had been preparing for years. Iran's domestic opposition was unlikely to be able to seize power in such a scenario. A limited air campaign or even a protracted war stood a serious chance of failing to achieve regime change. The NIC report was the final warning in a decades-long documented history of U.S. military intelligence planners predicting grim strategic outcomes in a war with Iran. Official analysis anticipated every major failure of a potential conflict, from the brutal arithmetic of interceptor production to the possibility that Iran might close the Strait of Hormuz. In this piece, American Net Site, we trace the public record of this analysis and show that it was widely dispersed and understood within the American military, intelligence, and political establishment. So that's the end of the quotes there, but you see, it leads to wonder why we are in this mess. I mean, is it the influence of Israel and the Zionists? Is it to simply have clowns and a narcissist for a president who can't listen to advice that he doesn't want to hear? It's hard to say. Don, what do you think?
It is an anomaly of one wild expectation. And the fact that they kept attacking Iran while they were having negotiations going on, I mean, that does not lead to trust between Iran and the U.S. when they did it twice.
Yeah, and similar things have happened with the Russians, who appear to have basically given up for the moment on any possible negotiations. One final paragraph. This is from Vihai Prashad, who is director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. And then we'll have quotes from someone else. Prashad said just a couple of days ago, the real challenge Iran has placed before Washington is therefore conceptual. Who defines the agenda? Who decides which bases, weapons, and alliances are destabilizing? Who controls the waterways through which the region's wealth passes? And must every settlement be guaranteed from outside? Or can regional powers, with all their rivalries, build enforceable arrangements among themselves? The next Middle Eastern settlement will not be durable if it resembles a surrender document. It will have to address, here's a list, nuclear restraint, foreign military deployments, maritime access, sanctions, missiles, and mutual non-aggression as parts of one security problem. Iran's achievement is not that it has solved that problem. It is that after decades of being forced to answer Washington's question, it has compelled the region to consider a different one. The issue is no longer what Iran must surrender. It is what every power, including the United States, must be prepared to negotiate. I thought that was a pretty good
BJ Prashad deep summary. Is very good, yes.
And now we have a passage from Jeffrey Sachs, professor at Columbia University. He's on the Glenn Deason program. The first part, which I'm going to skip past, is actually quite interesting. He discusses five steps or demands for Palestinian peace and statehood. So that was just a couple of days ago and recommended for those who want to learn more. Then he goes on to the issue of hegemonic security with the U.S., thinks it still has, back in the 90s. Hegemonic security by military and economic force versus mutual multipolar security recognition. In other words, mutual recognition is a key phrase. It's something you've heard many times on this program. So here's Jeffrey Sachs for a few minutes.
War started with the United States' attempt to assert its hegemony over Ukraine. Zbigniew Brzezinski spelled it out. It was the doctrine of the neocons. We're going to expand NATO anywhere we want, up to Russia's borders, surrounding Russia, in Georgia, in the South Caucasus, in Ukraine, around the Black Sea. That's our business. We are the superpower. Well, Russia had different thoughts about that. But that's where that war came from, because no one cared to listen to Russia's security concerns at all. And that's still true today. It's a blank wall to talk to any European leader that Russia has legitimate security concerns, okay? And now in the Middle East, it's exactly what you say. Netanyahu thought, well, I got the easy plan. I don't have to compromise on anything. We win because we have the United States. And there are famous clips of Netanyahu explaining to, I don't even know who he's talking to, we own the Senate, we own the Congress. We can get the United States to do what we want. The truth is, our crazy CIA and military as well have delusions. So they see Israel's hegemony in the Middle East is just fine because it's part of America's global hegemony. What's happening right now in part is Trump thinks I'm going to corner every export of oil, Venezuela. I'm going to demand that Mexico behave itself. I'm going to take over the Americas, as he's explained. I'm going to take over the Middle East. I'm going to choke off Russian oil through sanctions. I'm going to decide who gets energy in this world. Well, this is a madman thought. It leads to global disaster, but it's exactly that hegemonic idea. I don't have to deal with anybody. We don't have to discuss with Iran. We just have to kill them. That's all. And that's what they think they're doing right now. And it not only is it murder, but it doesn't work to achieve your own security. Israel is at far graver risk than it's ever been because of this. And so is the United States at graver risk because our risk is nuclear war. And we keep pushing the world closer to nuclear war through these actions of not respecting, even in discussion, the security interests of the other side. It's the same in Taiwan. We say, we're going to send arms as we like to Taiwan. China says, excuse me, Taiwan is part of China. Do not send arms on your own. That, for us, is a red line. The United States, filled with the idiocy that it is, the recklessness that it is, says, we don't have to listen to them. It's our business. We are the United States of America. And by the way, it's Trump, but it's also the CIA. It's also the Congressional Armed Services Committees. It's also the arms contractors. It's also Silicon Valley. They all have this delusion of we don't have to take into account anyone else's concerns. And that's what's leading us to disaster.
Just as a last question, how do you make...
We'll be back to that interview with Jeffrey Sachs by Glenn Deason. And to take a pause, because he kind of moves on to some bigger picture issues. But again, I thought that was a really great summary. And he puts it in the vernacular, but believe me, this guy has decades of experience and a lot of depth of experience in international matters.
He knows a lot of the people in the United Nations. He knows a lot of the people who are in power in Europe over the decades. And so he has all these contacts, and he's tried to bring some foresight knowledge into the European thinking, but it's really gone the other way.
Glenn Deason is excellent, also a Norwegian professor with writing on international relations and Russian specialty, and does a lot of good interviews. We got one more question from him and then Sachs's response.
Makes sense of the way that Iran was underestimated because, you know, you worked with a lot of state leaders around the world to see how they work, their strategic thinking, their considerations. How could it be that, you know, we have the reports suggesting that Trump dismissed the likelihood of Iran closing the Strait of Hormuz, which should have been the most predictable thing? The attacks on the U.S. bases seems to be an underestimated the weapons that Iran has at its disposal, or the belief that killing Khamenei would collapse the government and make people, you know, pour into the streets with American flags, and essentially also now the assumption that the threats will make Iran capitulate, even though they see this in an existential fight. It's, you know, it, I'm just wondering how they got it this wrong. Is it just hubris, or is this a disconnect with the intelligence community? I haven't seen this in previous wars. There have always been mistakes, but this seems to be something very, very different.
Well, remember the Iraq War, for example, how every single thing was wrong. Every prediction about the cakewalk that we were going to have and how democracy was going to come and so on. And there was an interesting interview in 2004. I think it was a Time magazine reporter, if I remember correctly, and a White House official, maybe Karl Rove, I'm not absolutely sure. But he was asked about, the reality of the situation. And the response from the White House is, excuse me, we create our own reality. This is part of the issue, which is when you are so powerful and arrogant, you just think we'll make it work. Trump didn't know what he was going to do after the first hour, but he said, we'll make it work. It's complete improvisation. Of course, the real lessons are that these are disasters. It said that it took 20 years for the United States to go from the Taliban regime in Afghanistan to the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. So that was a 20-year effort. They credit Trump that it took 9 days to go from Khamenei to Khamenei. So this is American efficiency. In other words, we're not accomplishing anything. We're going around in circles, killing a lot of people, spending a lot of money. Maybe that's part of the point, because they want to spend a lot of money. That is profits for somebody and losses for all the rest of us. But I think the main point is we don't even have a process in the security state right now. The United States planning on anything has collapsed. We're just in improv mode. We have a psychologically unstable president. We have a constitutional process that is over because Congress does not use its constitutional, it rejects using its constitutional authority and responsibility. And I can tell you in every area that I know of, there's no thinking going on. There are no reports, there are no studies. There's no careful scrutiny. There's no review. It's improvisation. It's flailing around. So frankly, none of this surprises me. We don't even have minimal processes of thought. We have a president who just makes up things as they go along, and you end up with everything fake. And then desperation. Oh, NATO has to come to our aid. Even China, which was the target of much of this, has to come to our aid. Where are our friends, says Donald Trump. My God, a five-year-old would show more self-awareness and responsibility, frankly.
Well, that about sums up our global disaster. Sorry.
But it's exactly that hegemony.
This thing won't turn off. Sorry, yeah, that was a nice summary of our clown show for presidency and his surrounding accolades. I've got a brief thing from retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkinson, who was a top assistant to Colin Powell some years back and a pretty strong anti-war voice with a deep military experience. He's being interviewed on Dialogue Works with Nima Al-Kashid. Nima Al-Kashid is a Iranian based in Brazil, does good interviews, platform called Dialogue Works. And we'll hear just a couple minutes or so from Lawrence Wilkerson.
Saying it to just say there is a huge motivation here, in addition to the state and the protection there.
One second. He's talking about the fact that the Iran IRGC, Revolutionary Guard Council, has benefited financially from the way the strategy has been conducted over there, so that we have a party with some self-interest in pursuing the war on Iran's side.
Thereof, and the people, and the protection thereof, for these people to want to continue this war and to get the great Satan out of the region, because they see that as the biggest threat to their fairly comfortable position. That's not a criticism. That's just a description of reality. And Donald Trump has no idea, because he doesn't know this. He doesn't study anything except grifting himself. He doesn't study any of the history or the reasons people might be fighting or the reasons that they are resolute, dedicated, and aren't going to quit. He doesn't do that. He doesn't care. He just attacks them when he wants to attack them. That's the sadness of all of this. There is no rhyme or reason other than Israel and David Barnea and Bibi Netanyahu and their hold on Trump, whatever that hold consists of. That's the only reason we're doing this. It's sickening when you think about it. I mean, look at the number of children we've killed in Iran, at a minimum. Look at the destruction we've done, at a minimum. And we're doing it for no reason whatsoever of consequence.
That, again, is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson being interviewed on the Dialogue Works program, Dialogue Works highlights in that specific case. So I want to shift a little bit for the second half of the program to look more specifically at issues around Israel, the Zionists, and Western governments, which are increasing censorship and police state tactics against supporters of Palestine and opponents of Israel's genocidal warring campaigns. This is actually in many ways worse in Europe than here, as people have heard plenty about campus issues and other things, but in mainland Europe and also in Britain, there's been some outrageous suppression of the kind of protesters just mentioned, supporters of Palestine and opponents of Israel. And one little bit of good news that just happened involves such a case in Britain, where a professor, David Miller, was at the University of Bristol, but he's an anti-imperialist, and they didn't like some of his statements at the university, and of course was getting pressure from the usual places, and he got suspended. The University of Bristol was on behalf of the Zionists punishing him. He appealed, and he basically won on appeal. And this is really interesting, because if you think that it's somehow a bit over the top to call Zionism an inherently racist, colonialist, and imperialist force, well, listen to this, because the Great Britain Court agrees with that statement. So here's their ruling in favor of Professor David Miller, who's demanding to be reinstated at University of Bristol. And I'm going to read just one good paragraph from the court's decision. And the claimant here again is Professor David Miller. Quote, "Nothing in the claimant's definition of Zionism was unclear or lacking in coherence." They're responding now to the prosecution or plaintiff. "On the contrary, his formulation of the belief, as noted by the tribunal at section 209, was perfectly clear. The tribunal was not required to construct a separate freestanding definition of Zionism. Rather, it required to focus upon the pleaded beliefs as agreed in the list of issues and consider the coherence and clarity of those beliefs." Now listen to this. It was coherent to describe as racist, unquote, an ideology that promoted the establishment of a state for only one race of people, Group A, in a territory that contained a large number of people of a different race, Group B. Racist. if the ideology was said also to involve the migration of members of Group A into the territory with the support of an imperial power to dislodge an indigenous population comprised of Group B, it could legitimately and coherently be described as colonial and imperialistic. So there you have it, my friends. It's a legacy of Great Britain dating back to 1917, and it's the last and perhaps the worst of the settler colonialist enterprises we have in the world today. And here we have the professor's defense being upheld by the appeal court. Like I said, a bit of good news on the censorship front. What do you think, Don?
Well, England is starting to wrestle with it. And yesterday on Democracy Now!, they had about some people publishing a new book about how complicit Britain has been in this whole affair. So there are glimmers of hope. I mean, the statement by the new prime minister was shown how lacking it was, and there's a long way to go, but there is mounting opposition.
That last statement I was able to quote, by the way, I got from a site that's pretty good. It's a Canadian, Dimitri Lascarius, who's based in Montreal. He's an anti-imperialist voice and an attorney, and his site is called Reason to Resist, with the number two rather than the word two in the middle, Reason to Resist. And that was Dimitri Lascarius interviewing Professor David Miller. So if you want to get more on that case, it's a pretty good interview. It's on YouTube. So there's more of this. And again, a lot of people don't realize how bad it is in various parts of Europe. One more example from Britain is that there are literally thousands, not one or two, but many thousands of people have been arrested simply for holding a sign saying, "I oppose Israel genocide," or "I support Palestine Action," which is a group that's been in court for their behavior. And so the majority of these people being arrested simply for protesting without even saying anything, holding up their signs, are seniors. So we need a little bit more of that kind of militancy in a number of avenues here. Now we have a couple more examples. Karen Knesel was actually the former foreign minister of Austria. That's not a lowly position. She's being made a non-citizen simply by working for the St. Petersburg State University, where she has academic credentials. And EU, an unaccountable, unelected body, has promulgated its own rules that can make life extremely difficult, nearly impossible, for critics of the war on Russia and critics of the Israeli war on Palestine and Iran. And so this woman, Karen Knesel, be interviewed on Glenn Deason. Again, the former foreign minister is being made a non-person, that is, They freeze your bank account. They take away your passport or visa. This has also happened to Mr. Baudel, who was very high up in Swiss intelligence. So they're attacking prominent people because they're not going along with the official agenda. And I'm going to hear a few words here from Karen Knesel, again on the Glenn Deason program, and describing what's happened to her, as well as Jacques Baud, who I just mentioned, from Switzerland. And these people are in an Orwellian world of being non-citizens with little opportunity to appeal. If you're outside your home country, you can't get back in. If you're in your home country, you can't get out.
Part. And this could be a symptom of our time. That is, the unipolar moment of the U.S. being the sole superpower has already come to an end. And we effectively live in a multipolar world, and without an agreement, without an agreement that replaces the idea that everything is simply under, you know, Uncle Sam's control, we're gonna continue to see the international system break down, the international economic system, that is. But I guess if we take a step back, what is the wider consequences then of this shift from unipolarity to multipolarity, not as a policy, but just as a reality of the distribution of power?
Well, let me bring in here a very concrete example of yesterday. It's a security alliance brokered between Turkey, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan. Interesting. Three powerful Sunni Muslim countries, which work together in larger entities like also the Conference of Islamic States. To a certain extent, they're all connected also via BRICS. To a certain extent, they are connected via other regional forms of cooperation. And it's interesting that they are heading for a closer military alliance. So we see this kind of regionalization, which is one form of multipolarity on many levels. And it's very often about security. So it's interesting that these three, which especially Saudi Arabia and Turkey, were at loggerheads a few years ago because of the killing of this Saudi American journalist, Mr. Khashoggi, in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. So they were really at loggerheads for various reasons. Turkey as a steadfast supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood, while Saudi Arabia considering the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. So there is now this kind of cooperation, which is one form of multipolarity as a reaction to the breakdown of the larger guarantees that existed. A country like Saudi Arabia has definitely understood that a U.S. military basis is not a guarantee for security, but it's a risk. It can be a casus belli. So there are changes happening, and these we see in West Asia, aka Middle East. We see that also in terms of, when we go back also once more to the BRICS, which is not a legal institution, it's just some sort of larger marketplace. But still, let me highlight that BRICS started in the early 2000s as an object. I remember commodity conferences which I attended where investors like Jim Rogers would say, go for BRICS. There you can make money. You can make a fortune. It's all about commodities. You know, it was all about hard and soft commodities. These were the early 2000s, and they created, it was investors who created this term of BRICS. BRIC, it was back then only, it was Brazil, Russia, India, China, having their important commodity producers and important commodity importers, namely China and India, with their tremendous industrial rise.
Well, just wanted to get you introduced to this woman who's being made into a non-person with her rights and accounts and whatever taken away simply for taking a position at an academic university, St. Petersburg State University. So this is a kind of sane level discussion that is somehow threatening because she's not going along with the war on Russia. Some of this reminds me, the debate around anti-Semitism, because Don and I recently in our book group read a book called Anti-Semitism, A Word in History. It's by Mark Mazower, 2025, published. Anti-Semitism is basically, I learned a lot from that book, it's a pseudoscientific late 19th century word, a linguistic deception to dignify an ideological and religious stance. Anti-Jewish became anti-Semitism. Israel, a settler colonialist project sponsored by Britain, evolved to assume Israel speaks for all Jews. Then anti-Israel became anti-Jewish or anti-Semitism. I'm going to go on in a minute here, Don. Do you have anything you want to add?
It's good that we keep going over these things because the media... just the last couple of days, National Public Radio had this rundown of how the war in the Ukraine by Russia, how that developed. Well, they had no history, and it is a, the unprovoked attack by Russia onto the Ukraine. Well, there's plenty of evidence about why it was provoked, but be that as it may. And then nobody talks about this peace agreement just a few months later that was hammered out in Istanbul between Russia and the Ukraine, and there would have been, going back to the original configuration of the Ukraine, but on April 9th, then British Prime Minister Boris Johnson flew to Kiev, Ukraine, to tell Zelensky, nope, don't sign that. Don't stop this war. The West will back you. And so the West has been the one that has promulgated, extended, and now it talks about more and more being involved with giving weapons to the Ukrainians, which only has the prospect of enlarging this whole conflict.
Okay, for the last quarter of the program, I've got two things. Well, here's a short quote again from Vihai Prashad, who I spoke of earlier, because I think it gives a slightly added perspective on what's going on in Palestine. And then I'm going to close with several minutes of really interesting talk between two economists, Richard Wolff and Michael Hudson. But here's a little bit from Vihai Prashad that's in Counterpunch just recently. Quote, in an attempt to foreclose the future of the Palestinian people, Israel also attacks their past. The ferocious assault on Gaza alongside the continued displacement campaign in East Jerusalem and the West Bank is accompanied by the systematic destruction of memory. Israeli violence surgically targets archives, cemeteries, family photographs, galleries, libraries, municipal records, museums, neighborhood landmarks, and theaters. Violence against these institutions tries to erase the material foundations through which a people remember themselves, allowing historical denial to become fact. I find that emotionally very hard to even read. All right, now we have Richard Wolff, professor at Amherst and in the New York City area, and Michael Hudson, a different kind of economist, but also very, very well known, and they're in a kind of dialogue on YouTube just a couple days ago, and it gets into a little broader perspective than we've covered on the program so far today. So here they are, Richard Wolff and Michael Hudson in dialogue. First on, well, you'll hear.
Or something like that. To remind everyone, the American military kills the people, sinks the boats by means of rockets or drones or both. These are people who have been convicted of nothing, have not been given a lawyer, cannot confront their accuser, cannot appear before a judge, cannot be adjudicated by a jury. All of that is denied them. They are simply killed. Up until this decision made to do this, the procedure for handling these people was to have either the Navy or the Coast Guard of the United States stop and board vessels that they might suspect of doing something illegal, to ascertain whether or not they were. In the event that they were, they would be towed to a place where they would go through a trial and all of that. If they were found guilty of doing drug trade, they would be given a sentence of imprisonment. Why? Because drug trade in the United States is not a capital crime. We don't kill people for that. What possible rationale could be given. By the way, last week, not that it's relevant to what I'm about to say, but last week, the Drug Enforcement Agency, under Mr. Trump, issued a report that there is no evidence that the flow of cocaine into the United States has been in any way affected by this program of killing these people. Well, I wasn't surprised, because that behavior couldn't possibly be justified by the so-called war on drugs. Because having been born and raised in the United States, here's what I know. There's been a war on drugs for at least 60 to 70 years that I'm aware of, most of my life. And I am as able to purchase those drugs with a short walk from where I live today as I was 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 25 years ago. So that war on drugs is one colossal failure. What's then the point? I think the point is to rev up the MAGA base, to get the, it's like a cheerlead. We're prepared to kill. We are prepared to kill people we designate as bad persons. Oh, to quote our president, bad hombres. That's his attempt at Spanish. Okay, we're gonna kill them. We're not gonna waste time. It's like a bad Western movie.
We're going to come back to that. There's some more really juicy comments from Wolf and then Michael Hudson that I think will surprise you. But again, these are comments you're not going to get in the mainstream. That's why we have Northern Sun News.
Not going to waste time with habeas corpus, with the Magna Carta, with traditions of law in and out of the United States. Nah, we're not going to have that. By the way, consistent with what Hegseth Miller and other high officials have been saying in other contexts. I think a decision to move towards a civil war and to do so with blunt extrajudicial violence is already made and has been made at the highest levels of this government. And I think it's a testimony and evidence for how much worse the crisis is than even people like Michael and me aver as we make our economic assessments.
Well, I can't disagree with what Richard said. I think a police state will emerge if there's no policy alternative put before the people. And what's needed is an economic doctrine and a policy to devise alternative policies. To say there is an alternative. My father was a political prisoner, a strike leader and union organizer in Minneapolis. And the Minneapolis 17 were the first socialists that were put in prison under the Smith Act the day before Pearl Harbor, in 1941. They were convicted for having socialist books on their shelves. So I've already seen that. The Attorney General under Roosevelt said it was the only thing that he was ashamed of for having done, but he did it because the Democratic Party needed to maintain its control of the labor unions without the labor unions having a socialist policy such as the Minneapolis 17. Minneapolis was the only Trotskyist city in the world, I think, during the 1930s. So, yes, I've seen all of this. The question is, how do you revive the discussion that people have been being put in jail for 80 years? Well, I guess that's a long discussion for a future occasion.
It certainly is, and maybe we'll get to some of that discussion here, not today, but if this program has a future, because we've got to figure out how to build an alternative movement, alternative politics in this country. Again, that again is Professor Michael Hudson and Professor Richard Wolf, actually, and I forgot to mention that that particular conversation was included on a platform from Robinson Earhart and a couple of other colleagues of his. Don, anything?
No, I was really shocked about Michael Hudson saying that his father had been arrested back there in 1941.
Smith Act was the famous beginning of anti-communist persecution in this country. Not the beginning, but a very key act.
A very key act. And it was built to try and bring about this victory, and that there was picking out various political tendencies in this country. So it was okay then to be a member of the Communist Party, because they were very much associated with the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, which became the ally of the U.S. in the Great War against fascist Germany and Japan and Italy. But it was the Trotskyists who were on the outs, and so they were the ones that were rounded up and prosecuted.
Another instance of this, how this evolved during World War II, was 1943-44 manipulation of the Democratic presidential nominee away from Henry Wallace, the second most popular Democratic progressive politician in the country after FDR himself. And the convention in the backdoor deal rigged it so they got Harry Truman in there as the next vice president, although Henry Wallace was the vice president and was seeking to be the vice presidential candidate again, but he was in favor of international cooperation and peace, which was not the agenda for the post-war by the Dulles brothers and the other planners. And so they aced out Henry Wallace, later made Secretary of Agriculture, and a very good Secretary of Agriculture he was.
And he tried to run for president in 1948. After the end of World War II, but by then...
The fix was in.
The fix was in.
The National Security Act and CIA Foundation, 1947, and so on.
With the whole tenor of the country changed, and so they had to be engineered how the climate of the United States and the policies, domestic, but mostly foreign policies, were turned against having any cooperation with the USSR. And so it became this Cold War, which set off many ramifications, especially during the 1950s.
But the key agenda was suppression of the domestic forces for progressive policies, public policies, health care, labor unions, and so on. All of this demand for this kind of movement was very strong after World War II, and that's why the foundations of McCarthyism and the persecution of leftists, socialists, communists, what have you, not only dates back to the 30s, as Michael Hudson was saying, but especially after World War II. Okay, we only got a few minutes left. I wanted to make mention of a couple of other things, sites that I highly recommend. Again, one on Glenn Deason is Chaz Freeman, an ambassador, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense, and he's really excellent. The guy really has a wealth of knowledge and a very straightforward, clear way of speaking. He's extremely knowledgeable about Saudi Arabia and the war in West Asia and the dynamics. Here's one quote from his comments. For a long time, this is about Saudi Arabia. This has been our big ally, as you know. For a long time, it was easier to visit Tibet than to visit Saudi Arabia. It's extremely insular and police state kind of environment, and still is in a lot of ways. Also want to recommend University of Arizona Professor David Gibbs on international relations. He's really very, very good. I've listened to several of his interviews. Recently, he was interviewed by Lena Petrova, on her site, World Affairs in Context. That, again, is University of Arizona Professor David Gibbs, G-I-B-B-S. Highly recommended. And lastly, some morbid statistics just to keep perspective on what's going on in all these wars. So far, and this is from official sources, U.S. service members killed, 18. Israeli soldiers killed, from and civilians from the Israeli Ministry of Health, 26 killed. In Lebanon, from the Lebanon Ministry of Public Health, 4,335 killed. That's in Lebanon. In Iran, according to Iran Ministry of Health, 3,468 killed. Now we come to Gaza. 1,259 killed since the beginning of Trump's so-called Gaza plan. At least 3,795 Israeli violations of that Gaza plan. And 73,388 killed during Israel's genocide, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. And that's a low figure because there are many more they don't know about still buried under the rubble. And now Israel is even taking away the evidence of their crimes.
It's what's going on in Gaza was broke the back of the Democratic Party in the last election, because you could see with your eyes all the, what was going on. And the Democrat candidates were denying. And so it takes a lot to overcome. And in the recent election, well, I hope it's going to be different now. Peggy Flanagan was much more open on some of these questions than Angie Craig, who was backed by AIPAC money and who is much more prone to be in favor of Israeli war aims.
I got time for one final paragraph. This is from a man named Aurelian, A-U-R-E-L-I-A-N. His site is called Aurelian2022.substack.com. And really interesting comments, different perspective about why wars happen. This is on top of the usual analysis of economic and military and strategic interests. But he talks a lot about fear and how fear on both sides contributes toward war, and it needs to be recognized and understood. So here's a quote ending his, and I recommend this for a much longer discussion. Simply put, during the Cold War, each side feared the other whilst being unable to understand how the other side could fear them. NATO initiatives to generate new forces, spend more money on defense, etc., were assumed by them to be stabilizing because they would discourage potential Soviet aggression. The Western belief that it was a waste of time even to bother speculating what the Soviet reaction would be was continued after the Cold War, with the poisonous addition that anyway what the Russians thought didn't matter because there was nothing they could do about it. And why should the Russians be afraid of the West anyway, they thought. Thus, the stumbling enlargement of NATO over the decades managed the difficult fear of getting the worst of all worlds. Let me repeat that sentence. Thus, the stumbling enlargement of NATO over the decades managed the difficult feat of getting the worst of all worlds. It worried and antagonized the Russians while simultaneously weakening NATO overall.
Well, this has been the Northern Sun Radio News with Dave Gunick, Don Olson, bringing you different perspectives on what's going on. Very, very far-reaching aspects to what happens in the world. And we have a different way of doing it, and we try and understand it.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
May 21st, 2001. Joan Rothfuss was thinking about a cellist. The Walker Art Center curator was sitting in the lobby of the Walker, waiting for a cellist to begin her performance. But this wasn't the cellist Rothfuss was thinking of. Her mind flashed on Charlotte Moorman, a classically trained cellist who in the 1960s fell in with a group of New York avant-garde artists, including Yoko Ono and John Cage. Moorman had gotten tired of the classical repertoire and embarked on a life as an experimental cellist, a career move that brought her to the attention of the New York City Vice Squad in 1967 when she performed topless. That stunt earned her a night in jail. Anyway, Rothfuss, the Minneapolis art curator, had one of those light bulb moments. She was going to write a biography of Moorman, an endeavor that had her devoting the next decade to the mostly forgotten cellist, who in her day had performed suspended in midair, covered in chocolate, and hanging from a trapeze. In 2014, Joan Rothfuss released her biography, Topless Cellist, The Improbable Life of Charlotte Moorman.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, Minnesota's community radio station.